Okay, so for those of you who don't know me, my name is Jonathan Ziering. I'm the Skan Rosh Beit Midrash of the YU Torah Mitzion Kol Zichron Dov. Okay. It's a mouthful. I have to get used to it. But okay, and thanks again to Ronnie and Mel for hosting. Okay, so the topic that we're going to deal with today is the question of overcharging in Jewish law. Now, the question, in all of its halachic intricacies, is very, very complicated. It covers many pages in the Talmud, and large sections of the later codes. But what I tried to do was pick out sort of the fundamentals, and to illustrate the principles that drive this area of law, and specifically how it speaks to a modern economy. So, you know, in my research, in addition to looking at the classic sources, there's a whole movement in Israel for the last 50 years called Mishpat Ivri, which is a area of scholarship in the academic world of people who attempt to take Talmudic principles and translate it into modern secular law or Israeli law, which is sort of some mix. So there are many articles written in Mishpat Ivri on overcharging, and they try to look at the laws of overcharging from the perspective of sort of a modern economy, looking for hints as to whether the Talmud would support a more socialist or more capitalist structure of pricing, some mix, what limitations there might be. So that's the eye that we're going to be looking at the sources with. You know, everything is on the page in the original and in translation. And before we read each source, I'll just quickly introduce which question it's going to answer. I've organized in such a way that we slowly build up the perspective in such a way that it sheds light on the modern situation. So the first source, which is this passage appears several times in the Talmud, just sets out the basic rule for overcharging. The Gemara says as follows: Amar Rava, Hilchas Apachos Mishtus Nikne Mekach Yosher Al Shtus Bitul Mekach Shtus Kana Umachzer Ona. That if someone is making a sale and he overcharges, he charges more than. And we'll see, one of the questions we're going to have to answer is how do we determine this abstract price from which we're determining a sixth? But if it's less than a sixth more than that price, whatever that might be, so then the sale is valid. We still have to ask whether, whenever you say the sale is valid, that still leaves open two possibilities, which is either it's valid, but it was incorrect to do, or it's valid and permitted, right, that... You know, so this law could either be saying that on the level of prohibition, right, you can't overcharge at all, but we won't, you know, negate the sale if it's less than a sixth over however we determine this price. Or you could say that no, this law that it's less than a sixth, you don't have to negate the sale, tells you that halacha views the range of legitimate prices within a sixth in both directions margin. A sixth, I should just point out, means a fifth, because the Talmud has a way of counting numbers. Right, whenever we talk about a fifth or a sixth, we could mean a sixth of the projected total or of the original. So if you have $100, a fifth of the original would be 20. The total would be 120. And then, therefore, a sixth of the new total is the fifth of the previous total. The Talmud tends to use fractions in the latter sense. So it's a sixth of the new total, which is the fifth of the original. So 20% above the original price or less, the sale is going to be valid. More than one-sixth, from that theoretical price, the sale is nullified. And if it's exactly a sixth, so then the sale is valid, but you have to return the overcharge. You have to return the amount above the legitimate price, again, however we determine that. So that's the basic law that appears several places in Talmud. But like I said, looking at this, right, it doesn't shed much light on what it means to overcharge, what types of things are under this law, or how we determine price. It just says that once we've determined the price, however we've done that, so then you can't overcharge more than a sixth, or a sixth or more. So what we're going to do is try to figure out how exactly we conceive of prices, where the sixth is coming from, what it limits, and what that tells us about the economic system. So the second source here first deals with the question of whether this less than a sixth amount, this dispensation that if you charge less than a sixth more than the going rate, that the sale is valid, whether that means that the sale is valid and it's permitted, meaning, as I said, that halacha views legitimate price range within a sixth more or a sixth less of the original price, or if really you aren't allowed to overcharge at all, it's just that we won't bring you to court, we won't actually enforce these minuscule levels of overcharging, but in fact it's forbidden anyway. So that is two positions in the Rush and Rabbi Usher, who is a 12th century French scholar. It's cited as well by his son in Rabbi Yaakov Balaturim in chapter 227, and in Shulchan Aruch in the basic code of Jewish law there as well. And he cites both positions. He says, V'yired de'bechol shar dvarim afilu pachos mishtos osur la'anos es chavero im yesh bo shavet pruta kevin sheyadua she'ein meko shava kol kach. So the Rush's first position is that it seems that even if you charge less than one-sixth over the going rate, even a little bit, it's still going to be forbidden because you know that the object is not worth that. The Rachman Amar, because the Torah says, Al tonu b'chol davar sheyesh bo shivui mamon, his hira Torah shelo yane es chavero. Because the Torah commanded that you shall not overcharge or literally oppress your friend in any monetary area, which means you can't overcharge at all. Ella, she'amru chachamim da'ad shtos have a mechila. But the sages assume that until one-sixth, people will forgive the overcharging, they'll relinquish their rights to get them, their money back, it's not worth their time. Lefi shekach derach mekach umemkar, because that's how business works. Lefi shelokech v'mocher enam yecholim lechavein demei mekach bitzimtzum, because people, it's hard to determine the exact price, and since neither the buyer or the seller is sure to the last penny how much this should be worth, so we have a little bit of leeway. But if you know that you're overcharging, then that would be forbidden. Derech ha'olam limchol ta'utam adshtud. And the world forgives mistakes until one-sixth. Aval im ha'mocher baki be'erach mechavero. But if the seller is an expert and knows that the price is not correct, and the buyer is not as expert, or the other way around, where the buyer is an expert. You have a an expert art salesman. He walks into a garage sale and he sees a piece of art, and he knows that it's worth $1 million, and the person at the garage selling it at the garage sale thinks it's $100. Right? That would be the same problem, right? Where the buyer is the expert and not the seller, right? Where he is more of an expert. Yodim b'mocher al yanuzet ze imlo sheyifareish. So they can't overcharge. And the second possibility, oh shehu dachuk limaot hilkach atrud hevi bechlal demei mekach. Or do you assume that the buyer, the seller rather, really wants to sell in the time of Chazal, where it wasn't as much of a capitalist, business-oriented society. Most people didn't sell things unless they were in need of money. There was less of a market culture. People would sell when people were selling their private property, right? Their clothes, the clothes off their back, because they needed money for food, right? So it's possible that we could say that since, look, the seller is selling it and he knows that, he doesn't really want to sell, but he's selling it anyways. So therefore, it's just, you know, that's just the way it is. He might be asking a little bit more, and that's okay. Hilkach atshud havei bechlal demei mekach, and therefore, perhaps within the sixth range, that's simply the regular price. The ein kan shem ona klal, and therefore, it's not considered overcharging. Vitzarach ion, right? He's not sure. V'yarei shemayim yotzei yedei kulam. But one who fears God should fulfill all the positions. So the first question as to whether this sixth standard tells us that there's an actual range of prices. Again, we still haven't determined what a price is. But that there is a range of prices. So the rush is two positions. Is either that is the case, that this one-sixth thing is telling you, one-sixth more, one-sixth less, that's all legitimate. Or he's saying, no, in fact, that's not what the Torah is telling you. What the Torah is telling you is that there is a price. You can't overcharge. The buyer can't push undercharging. But because of enforcement laws, we can't, enforce to the last penny. So we assume that you've forgiven a mistake within a sixth range. But really, there is some sort of abstract price that you have to keep to, and you can't budge from it even a penny in either direction. Those are the two positions that the rush raises. And like I said, that's carried through. Both of these positions carry through to the codes. But again, this still doesn't fully answer the question, because all this does is say that there's two positions as to whether this sixth provides a legitimate price range or not, but we still don't know what is a price. Right? How do we determine a price? That's still an open question that we haven't touched. Before we get to that question, I want to ask one more question, which is the laws of overcharging and the prohibition to overcharge. If I asked you, who is it meant to protect primarily? Right? So we have two possibilities. The laws of overcharging are either protecting who? The buyer. Both, right? It's clearly also protecting the buyer, right? But it may be that the laws of overcharging aren't just protecting the buyer. They're also protecting the seller.
Well, in the case before, we were talking about where the buyer has the information advantage.
Right. So in that case, I should rephrase. Either it's protecting the person who is overcharged, right? Whether that's the buyer or the seller, overcharged / undercharged, the person who's being disadvantaged, or it's actually protecting both people, the person being disadvantaged and even the person being advantaged at some level. His rights are hidden in this story. Now, what would that look like, right? What would it mean for the laws of overcharging to not just be protecting the disadvantaged but the advantaged? So if you look in source 3, we find these two positions. Again, each of these positions is a long exposition in the respective medieval commentaries. So I brought the summary of it from the tour. This is the son of Rabbi Asher in source 2. So he wrote a code of Jewish law. So in his summary, he raises these two positions. So he says, this one we'll read in the English. It's not as important to see in the original, but the original is right there. If the overcharge was more than one-sixth by even a bit, such as if he sold the object worth 60 for 70 plus or 50 minus, the sale does not revert unless the one who was overcharged claims the money. Then the one who overcharged can say, I won't return it. Rather, the sale will be nullified and each shall take his own. Right, so the first position he raises is that the laws of overcharging are meant to only protect the one who is overcharged. And therefore, he says that this law, that if you've overcharged more than a sixth, that the sale reverts, it's nullified, isn't an absolute rule. If the buyer says, look, I understand, you overcharged me 50%, 100%, 200%, but I want that object. And I know that if I demand my money back, the seller has the right to say, you know what, I'm not going to give you your money back, take the object back, I'll find somebody else who I can overcharge, right? That he has that right. So if you think that the laws of overcharging are meant to protect the disadvantaged, then until the disadvantaged party initiates the complaint and says, I want my money back, the overcharger or the undercharger, whatever the case may be, doesn't have a right to renege on the sale because his rights aren't in question. Right? If the buyer, let's say, right, in a case where the seller overcharges, if the buyer says, I want my money back, so then the seller can say, look, I don't want to give you your money back, I'm going to renege on the sale. But if he doesn't say that, so the seller can't say, you know what, I want to renege on the sale even though you don't want to. I realize that it was a mistake and I want to go back on the sale. Right? If you view the laws of overcharging as simply protecting the rights of the disadvantaged party, then he is the only party who is able to initiate this nullification of the sale. But there's another possibility, right? So now if we continue, if the overcharge wants the sale to remain, does not ask for the money back.
Will the seller have that right if he gave, I don't know, a significant discount to a customer? Now he's unhappy with that.
So,
the discount, I shouldn't have given 50%, 30%, 20% would have been my
kind of market. Not if they specified it before. Right. If they outlined before and said, I know this is the price, but I'm giving it to you for less, then they've both lost their rights. Right, because then everything was on the table. Right? The classic laws of it, overcharging are only when it's not on the table, right? Where they're right. If you say I'm giving you a sale for whatever reason, forbidden or not, it will work. Right? There's in monetary law, right, this tends to be, right, this happens a lot, that even if something's forbidden, right, if you, as long as you say explicitly, I understand that I'm violating the law, but I'm doing it anyways. So, in monetary law, we'll give you a slap on the wrist and say that wasn't a good thing, but we'll let you do it and we'll enforce it. Now, the classic case is interest, where interest is always forbidden, but once you make a transaction with interest and the money is given over, the courts will enforce that sale even though it's forbidden. And again, whether the sale is forbidden or not depends on the question we haven't seen yet, is how do you determine this price to begin with? So that's one perspective on the laws of overcharging. However, he continues, Rabbeinu Yonah, this is Rabbi Jonah Garandi, 13th century Spain, writes that even if the overcharged does not claim the money, the overcharger, can nullify it. For as long as the overcharged can renege, so can the overcharger. This is because the overcharge is more than 1/6, the sale is not worthy of remaining, so it is like doing a business deal without performing an act of acquisition. And if you look at the position of Rabbeinu Yonah in the original, this is in Baba Basra, what becomes clear is that he actually thinks the laws of overcharging are much more complicated than simply, we want to protect the disadvantaged. And he says, really, the way the system works is as follows, is that the monetary system is built on a series of reciprocal rights. The buyer has rights, and the seller has rights. And this division that we have, less than one sixth, and more than 1/6, is not just gradations of how egregiously the overcharger disadvantaged the buyer, but rather it's a way of balancing the two opposing rights that exist in every sale. And the way he describes it is as follows. The buyer, he has a certain amount of rights. His rights say that if the sale is overcharged too much, if there's too much overcharge, then he has the right for the sale to be nullified. The seller's rights tell you that he has the rights to sell his property up to a certain point without having to worry that he might have overcharged by a few pennies. Right? He has rights to engage in the monetary system as well, and he has rights that a sale that was overcharged by 10 cents is not going to undo it. He doesn't have to be always worried that, oh, maybe I made a mistake at the margins and tomorrow I'm going to have to worry that someone's going to come back to my store and I'm going to spend my entire day at the complaints desk returning because it was overcharged a dime. He has rights as well. And what he says is that those rights each are interpreted in the numbers of a sixth. Right? You each have rights of a sixth. Where do they collide? At 1/6. And at 1/6, they have equal rights. Right? The overcharged has the right to get his money back. But the overcharger has not lost his right for the sale to remain. So the compromise that's created when their rights collide is to say the sale will remain, but you'll have to return the overcharge. And therefore, he says, if you overstep the 1/6 boundary in either direction, this sale is so egregious that it doesn't, then it automatically reverts to nothing, because whenever a sale is more than 1/6 off the regular price, then everybody has the right to reclaim the rights, because the laws of overcharging to begin with were a balance of rights. Now, this question of whether the laws of overcharging are an expression of our concern only for the consumer, shall we say, or is actually an attempt to balance the competing rights of the consumers and the producers, of the buyers and the sellers, will affect how we think the laws of overcharging will be reflected into a modern economic system. They'll look very different. Right? If you think that it's about balancing rights, it looks then the laws we're going to formulate will probably look much more capitalist. Right? We're trying to protect the buyer while protecting the seller, and everyone has rights, and we're trying to balance them. If you think the laws of overcharging tells us that we always give the benefit of the doubt, so to speak, to the buyer, right, or to the right, then we would assume that halacha wants more, let's say, price controls, because the ethos behind the law, even if not the details, the ethos behind the law are heavily weighted in the person who's normally overcharged, right, the consumer's direction. So this dispute sort of opens up for the, you know, the question of what do the laws, I'm going to have an extra source if you want, the question of, again, what is this telling us about the economic system? Okay? So now, that brings us to the next question. As I mentioned, the sort of the question that's been begged to this point is we keep talking about a sixth more, a sixth less. But as I said, we haven't talked about the price. Where does the price even come from? What is this notion of price? And we can't fully answer the question of what type of economic system halacha envisions until we know where that magic price is coming from. So what are the possibilities, right? Where could the price come from, right?
What the market.
So one is the market, right? Is that all the price means is that 1/6 more, 1/6 less only tells you that once a price has been determined by the open market, so you have to be fair. But what the price is left in the hands of the market, right? Which would, you know, if we conceptually mapped it on, works better with the notion that halacha is envisioning a system of balancing rights, right? We care both about people's ability to make money on the things that they're selling, on the work that they're doing. Once we've determined that price through a free market or whatever the case may be, so then you can't go beyond that price. What's the other possibility? Right, we're all from, you know, capitalist society, so we only have one idea of what a price could mean.
Formulaic based on the cost.
Right, formulaic or government, right? Like some sort of external force which is protecting whoever arbitrarily. Now there is a third possibility, which is that it will depend on the item, right? That we would have a mixed system, as we do in most societies at this point, right? This is true in the States. I don't know if it's true in Canada. I haven't checked yet. It's definitely true in Israel that prices are normally determined by the market with certain exceptions. In Israel, it's bread, eggs, cheese, and milk. In Canada, it's gas. Right, gas is determined by the right government, right? I think so.
No.
Theoretically not.
Theoretically not.
Dairy and egg product because of the
right.
Let's talk dairy milk. Yeah, you know, bread, and even the States, it's bread also. There's another possibility, which is to say it depends on the item, and we'll see that actually halacha takes this middle view. Now there are other factors, right? Even when we talk about the market price and things like that. Right, there are still other factors because, you know, as we all know, the market price for an object isn't uniform. Right, there's a price for wholesale and a price for retail because we add into the price, you know, context and how much effort it took to get the item to this point. And halacha is going to build that all in. But let's approach the first question: is where do we get the basic price? So, like I said, there are two central directions we could take, either that the open market determines it or that it's determined by some government force. And we actually find a dispute about this in the medieval commentaries based on a passage in source 4. So the Gemara in Bava Basra 90b has a case of people who were attempting to raise the price. Right, who were hoarding produce in order to drive prices up. That's the context of this passage. So the Gemara says as follows, source 4, Tanu Rabbanan, Otre Peros, those who hoard fruit, Umalave Beribis, or lend money on usury, Umaktine Eifa, or they reduce the measures, and meaning they, right, they unfairly or they dishonestly change the their weights and measures, Umafkia Sharim, and those who raise prices, Alei and Akaz of Omer, scripture says about them, Leimor Masai Yaavor Hachodesh Vinashbira Shever Vehashabas Viniftechabar Lahaktin Eifa Ulahagdil Shekel Ulavet Mosne Mirma. This is one of the sort of sharpest critiques in the prophets, where the prophet is imagining how evil and how corrupt society is. He says, you have all these people who pretend to be religious. They keep Shabbos, they keep Yom Tov, they keep all the holidays, but all they do all of Shabbos is say, how many hours till Shabbos is over so I can go and cheat people? Right, that's the what it's imagining, right? It's right. It's that's the image in the and the prophet, right? Again, right? When is the Shabbos over so that I can be deceitful? Uksiv, and they quote another verse, Nishba Hashem b'geon Yaakov imeshkach l'netzeach kol masayem, that God swears by the pride of Jacob that I will never forget any of their work. Right? This level of corruption is beyond the pale. But the question that the Gemara doesn't address is, okay, so you hoard fruit to drive the price up. But what? From where are you driving the price up? Are you simply playing with the market? Or are you sort of circumventing some price that has been set by the government and forcing people to pay more than the quote-unquote objectively correct price? What is the what is it talking about? So that's a dispute between Rashbam, who is Rishmuel, one of the Balei HaTosfot, one of the early Balei HaTosfot in the 12th century, and the Rambam and Maimonides. So in source 5, in the comments of the Rashbam to that passage in the Talmud, he says, Otre Pero, those who hoard fruit, Shekonin Beshuk Lotzram, that they buy it in the marketplace to hoard them, Limkor Biyoker, to sell them at expensive prices, Vigormin Shemit Yaker Ashar, Vikaf Sedanim, and they cause the market price to go up, and they cause the poor to lose. So the Rashbam says, who's determining prices? The market. And what the Talmud doesn't like is people who go out of their way to play with the market by hoarding things to, right, to change the supply and demand, you know, the facts on the ground. Really, there should be a glut of let's say, fruit, of bread, and therefore it should be cheap, and the poor should be able to eat it, and they drive the prices up by only releasing X number of fruit, X number of loaves of bread per day. But the price, the Rashbam is imagining, is determined by the market. The Rambam argues not that way. And he says in Source 6, Chayavin beitin lahamid shotrim b'chol medina, u'medina b'chol pelech u'pelech. The courts must set up police in all provinces and all counties. Shehu mechazrin ala chanuyot, to go to the stores, umatzdikin et hamoznayim, and check the weights. Veramido, right, the weights and the balances, uposkin et hasharim, and to set the prices. The kol shemi shemafkia et hashar, umochir biyoker, and anyone who hoards to change the price and sells it more expensively, makinozo, we beat him, mekovinozo, mocher kishar ashok, and force him to sell at the market price, which was determined by the government. So the Rambam, in contrast, the Rashbam, thinks that at least for these items, for food, and we'll get to what items he's talking about, the market doesn't determine the price, the government does. And so Dr. Itamar Warhaftig uses this sort to note that already we have hints here in this dispute between the Rashbam and the Rambam, the beginnings of a dispute of how are you imagining the economy as a free market economy, or is it as a government-controlled, more socialist economy. But as we'll see, that's not really totally true. And we'll get to that in a minute. Now, another point that I raised is that one of the things that's going to go into the price is going to be effort and production costs. Meaning that the same object could cost one thing in one context and more in another context, right? More at retail than it does at wholesale, and more at, you know, I don't know, the ball game than it does at your local supermarket. So that is also, that's an explicit passage in the Talmud that you're allowed to take that into account. That's in Source 7. V'amar Shmuel hamistaker yoser al ashtus, one who profits should not profit more than a sixth, as we've seen. Then the Gemara says, but Ika Gulfe Vishamre, Yahi Nafish Le Tve Mishtos, leaving aside exactly what the case is. So the Gemara said, but in this case, the point is, isn't he charging more than a sixth? And it exceeds a sixth. So he said, that's true, but Ika Tirche Udeme Barzanaisa. In that case, this person is paying for his effort and the crier, meaning for advertisement. Right, so the Talmud already recognizes that whatever the price is, it's not uniform. The person who has to provide more marketing and more effort to get the product to the market, he has the right to charge more than whatever this price is. And we've already seen that the two ways of conceiving of prices. Okay, so until now, what we have is we have the first tension, which we saw, which is, are the laws of overcharging attempting to protect primarily the buyer, which again will push in the sort of more socialist direction, or is it trying to balance rights of the buyers and sellers, sort of conceiving more of a modern capitalist society? And the second question, which falls on that same sort of dichotomy, is who is determining this price? And there we have the dispute between the Rambam, the Maimonides on the one side, and the Rashbam on the other. The Rambam saying it's determined by the government, and the Rashbam saying, no, it's determined by the open market, again, falling on this same sort of dichotomy between a more socialist system and a more capitalist system, a more free market and a more controlled system. However, what throws a wrench into all of this is that this sort of beautiful dichotomy would work very nicely if the laws of our overcharging applied equally to all things in the market. But that may not be true, and if that's not true, what it may be leading us to is a more mixed system, which is what most societies have at varying levels. And that begins with source 8, where we'll see that so far we've assumed that the laws of overcharging apply equally to all products. But the simplest read in the Talmud is that that's not the case at all. So if you look at source 8, and this is what I brought up with the bread and eggs and milk and the like, source 8 is the continuation of the passage in Baba Basra. It says, Tani Namihachu, we've taught this elsewhere as well. Ein oats and peiros, we don't hoard fruit. And then the Gemara says, what is that? Dvarim sheish ben chayin nefesh, things that are life's necessities. Kagon, you know, like wine, which in their time was not a luxury, it was a necessity. If you read, for example, Chaim Soloveitchik's...
Still is.
What? In a different way. If you read Chaim Soloveitchik's book on wine in the medieval period, you'll see, now people may like wine, but we drink other things, maybe grudgingly, maybe not, but we drink other things. In the time of... In the medieval period, this was not true at all. In the Talmudic period, it was not true. The water was contaminated. Right? They drank wine or beer. They drank alcoholic beverages. That was what they drank. That was their water. That was their juice. That was their milk. That was their coffee. Right? That was all they had. In fact, if you look at the letters, the records of the Mayflower, I'm not talking to Americans, the Mayflower being the right, which landed at Plymouth, Rock, one of the early voyages to the New World. They ended up in Plymouth, Massachusetts. And they weren't actually aiming for Plymouth, Massachusetts. I think they were aiming for Virginia, for Jamestown, where there was already an established community. And the reason they ended up in Plymouth, if you see in their letters, is because we were traveling and we ran out of beer. And they said, we hardened sailors, we can drink water, but the poor women and children, they can't drink water, so we needed to stop to find beer. Right? So they didn't drink water. Water was not in the cards. Wine or beer was the I believe this is Chaim Soloveitchik's description. Wine was the water and the juice and the coffee and the milk. Like, it was everything. That was what you drank. So wine, shmanim, and oil, v'salatot, and flour. And again, it was a very bread-based society in that sense. Right? You had coarse bread, and if you were poor, that was basically what you ate. Those things you can't try to make a profit or too much of a profit on. And Amru Allah, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Shavim Mistaker, Biyayin, Shemin, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah would get profit from wine and oil. And right, he felt that these were not as necessary, that really only bread was the, you know, life's necessities. And Tanur Rabbanan Ein Mistakrin Pa'amayim Beveitzim. You can't make profit twice from eggs. Now, what does twice mean? So, Amar Mari Bar Mari, there are two positions. Pligi Barabu Shmuel, Chad Omar Al Chad Trey. One says that what it means is that for eggs, you can't make 100% profit, right? Chad Omar Tagar Letagra. And the other one says it means that eggs you shouldn't sell through multiple dealers, thereby increasing the price each time you go from wholesale to retail to retail to retail. So that, and both of those positions, there's a dispute in amongst the commentaries which one we rule like. So this Gemara, though it's the parameters of it are not totally clear, puts a large limitation on what things actually fall under the laws of overcharging, and says that it's only this sort of abstract category called Dvarim Sheyesh Ben Chayei Nefesh, necessities of life. What exactly that means is unclear, and you have a slight range of positions. So the Rambam's summary of it in source 10, again to Maimonides, and then we'll see in source 11 the dispute about what exactly he said. So we'll just quickly read. We'll read the English for the Rambam because we're just reading him as background for the dispute in 11. We've already explained that if a person buys and sells in a faithful manner, saying this is the extent of profit that I'm making, the laws of overcharging do not apply. Even if he says I purchased the article for a seller and I'm selling it for 10, this is permitted. So as I said before, right, he says the laws of overcharging don't apply when you're clear about how much you're overcharging. Nevertheless, but it does apply in a certain circumstance, which is the court is obligated to regulate prices and appoint officers of the law so that people at large will not be able to reap whatever profit they desire. Instead, the court should regulate that a person should earn only a profit of a sixth. A seller should not profit more than a sixth of his investment. When does the above apply with regard to articles on which our lives depend? Examples, wine, oil, and fine flour. With regards to herbs, costus, frankincense, and the like, by contrast, a set limit is not established by the court. The seller may take any measure of profit he desires. If you look at 11, so now you have a dispute about what he means. So, Kasev HaMagid Mishnah, so the Magid Mishnah, who is an early commentary on the Rambam, writes, in the end of the day, we don't even include eggs within this category. Right? What laws are subject to the laws of overcharging? Bread, oil, very, very central. Everything else, snacks, eggs, is considered a luxury item. You're allowed to overcharge. Now, there is an element of the laws of overcharging that remains, which is you can't be fraudulent. Right? But if you're open about it and you say, look, I understand that this diamond, right, is a rock that came from the ground, right? It's not really worth $50,000. As long as you say that, right, or everybody knows it, you're fine. You can charge whatever you want. You can't pretend that it's, you know, that it's diamond and it's cubic zirconia. That you can't do. That would be overcharging and mekachtos, and that'd be fraud. That you can never do. But in terms of whether or not you're allowed to charge as much as you want, he said, look, the way the Magen Mishnah understands Rambam is that the only thing that's limited by these laws, the a priori limitation of a sixth profit, is only bread and, you know, bread and nowadays, I guess, bread and water, let's say, right? Eggs aren't even included. The Kesef Mishnah slightly expands it himself, and he says, "Vein dvar of nirin chlal shadavar pashut who debates him yoser chayin nefesh hay mehashmanim." Said, "No, eggs. If oil is necessary, eggs are even more necessary." Lo odel the matzah shkol shuhu machal b'chal dvar sheish bim chayin nefesh. So it seems to him that food, all food, are things which life depends on. Okay, so he has a slightly more expanded thing. He thinks that food is all under that category of things that life depends on, and therefore are limited by this rule of 1/6. The Sma, who is a commentary on Shulchan Aruch, on the Code of Jewish Law, so he sets up a slightly different model, and he says, the law, I'll just look at it in English, the law is divided into three categories for Rambam. One, articles which life depend on, and the like, such as wine, oil, sorry, there's a typo, and flour, you can profit up to a sixth and no more. Articles which are not food at all, such as cosmetics and incense, you can profit as much as you want, even many times the principal. things which are necessary for food, such as cumin or other spices and the like, is permitted to benefit up until 1/6. So he thinks there's actually a three-pronged model, is that the more necessary something is for life, the more strictly regulated it is, and the more something's luxury, the more it's left to the free market without any regulation. So if you take it all together, what I think the, you know, the simplest understanding of the sources is that primarily the Talmud believes in a capitalist model, right? Anything which is a luxury is left up to the open market. You have to be honest, right? You can't overcharge. You can't pretend that you're not charging extra and then charge extra. That's being fraudulent, and that's always prohibited. But beyond that, you're allowed to charge whatever you want. But there's clearly a voice that says that no, you can't. Things which are necessary for life, a certain measure of control is called for. But even there, we found a dispute. The Rambam, let's say, has a model sort of like what they have in Israel and the States, and I guess in Canada, where certain basic necessities, you know, again, milk, bread, eggs, whatever it is, are price controlled, right, by the government and not by the market. But the Rashbam, as we saw, takes an even more expansive model, which is no, that even those things, so we're stricter about the laws of overcharging because we don't want you to, you know, make it hard for the poor to buy food. But that just means that we're stricter about enforcing the 1/6. But in terms of determining the price, even those things, the Rashbam thinks, the price is determined by the market. So in the end of the day, coming back to our original question, is that it does seem to be that the sort of the preponderance of evidence is that the Torah system is balancing these two values. It's not just that it has a socialist system where it always gives the preference to the buyer, to the consumer, to the, right? No, it's balancing values, and actually, in many ways, especially in luxury items, the benefit is always given to the seller because it's a luxury. You don't want it, so don't buy it. In terms of things which are necessary for life, the Torah there has some limitations. And again, though we've seen a range of whether even there we think that it's determined by the government or by even that's the open market, and what types of things are limited. Well, again, we saw, you know, three positions. We have the Kesem Mishnah thinks that all food falls under the category of things that should be at some level price controlled. The Magen Mishnah thinks that it's only the very bare necessities of life. And the Sma, who says that it depends, right? Luxuries, total luxuries, we don't limit at all. Things which life really depends on, so then we limit to this 1/6. And we're slightly more lenient with things that are in the middle, like spices. So if you take the evidence together, right, the Torah does have something to say about the sort of the modern economic system, and it seems to create some sort of balance system like this, where for the most part, most things that are bought and sold are in the open market, with some recognition given that, you know, if everything is left to the open market, the poor and the disadvantaged will not be able to put food on the table, and that, so at that sort of margin, we enforce stricter standards. But at least I think that's the best case that I can build from the sources. But I don't know what people's thoughts are, questions, further comments on it.
So where would the market be? I mean,
so that's one of the
market in Richmond Hill is the market all of Greater Toronto.
Right. So that's one of the questions that people really struggle with nowadays is what is the market? I was listening to a shiur by Rav Schechter, where he threw out a definition. He thought that the market was anywhere someone would reasonably go to buy that object. So he said, for perishables, let's say, it would be as far as people go for perishables. Right? People don't order their milk online on Amazon because, you know, it'll spoil. So if people will go, let's say, you're in Thornhill, you go as far as, you know, I don't know, the No Frills on, you know, near Wilson. So that would be your market, right? But for something you buy online, right, he said, you know, like, I don't know, canned goods, right, which if you wanted to, you could buy online, right? The market would be whatever it's legitimate anywhere in the world, anywhere you would start buying from. But yeah, I mean, part of the problem is what is the market? He had this common sense one, is that it's it's as far as people will realistically go to buy that object. So he thought, even if you think the laws of overcharging would apply to books, which as we've seen, they probably don't in the classic sense. So then, yeah, people buy from Amazon. So like, any bookstore, look on Amazon, what's the price? That would be your approximate six.
It is a convenience factor, right? I mean.
Well, but as we saw,
as a consumer, might be happy to pay the extra 20% because I don't have to go into my
for sure, and that's and as
half an hour through the traffic or whatever the case.
Right, and we saw before that one of the things that you pay for is is effort and advertisement, and built into that is probably also convenience, right? Like we all understand that 24-hour a day supermarkets charge more than supermarkets that close at 10. Right, that's just the way it is, because we know we're paying for the convenience, we're paying for the ability to buy, and even if milk is a necessity of life, milk at 3 o'clock in the morning is not a necessity of life, right? So even in milk and eggs, right? Yeah, you are paying for convenience, and they're allowed to charge you for that, right? So, and that will affect how we determine the prices, and yeah, 7-Eleven or. Has the right to charge you the extra dollar in milk. You know that going in, that you're paying for convenience. You're paying for them to provide staff 24 hours a day. Are they open 24 hours a day in Canada? Yes. They are.
Awesome.
Metro, whatever.
Some of you spoke many about goods, and goods are easy because goods, there's a price. It's something that seems tangible. What happens with the stuff that's less tangible?
So the discussion I sort of shied away from, but this is also dealt with extensively. People gave the emails. I can always send follow up material. Is services, which is even more complicated.
Services, property, necessity.
Right. So services also seem to be subject in a similar way. Right. Luxury services would be. Same way, you could charge whatever you want as long as you're honest about it. And essential services, if we took the ethos and not just the letter of the law, probably would be limited in the same way. Property is interesting because the Gemara says about property that eino na'al lekarkos. There is no overcharging by property because most goods are perishable. At some point, they're perishable. And therefore, you're buying and selling them based on their current price. But land, right, as you look at the prices in Toronto, right? So 25 years ago, you bought a house for $1 million, people would have thought you're overcharging. Now, right, those people are making a killing selling that same house for $2 million, right? So the Gemara actually says, eino na'al lekarkos, that property is much harder. Then the Gemara says, then there's a dispute, rather, that ensues, is when we say eino na'al lekarkos, does it mean it? Right? Or is it just that we're looser on it, right? And the Yerushalmi argues that by real estate, there is ona, but it's not 1/6, it's 100%. You can charge up to 200% of the actual value, and that will be fine. But again, you'd have to determine how do you get to that value. And the second question that they deal with is, even if it's, when you say eino na'al lekarkos, does it mean that you're allowed to overcharge, or does it just mean that we will never renege on the sale? But it's still prohibited. But yeah, I took sort of the easy cases, which is goods, but real estate is much more complicated. And whatever the law is, in however you settle all those disputes, real estate is clearly more malleable, right? And the prices are more malleable than goods. And services are also part of this complication, but all of them will have it. But these are sort of the simplest cases. But yeah, the more abstract you get, the more difficult it gets to determine the proper price, and that's why Postgum sort of struggle to find the language to pin it down. And like I said, anyone who's signed up and anyone who hasn't, just remember too, I can send out some of these articles in Mishpat Ivri if people want to follow up a little bit. Okay. Shkaya.